Since 2011, American Giant has been making everyday clothing with extraordinary effort. Not in far-off factories, but right here in the USA. We obsess over fabrics, fit, and details, because if you're going to wear it every day, it should feel great and last for years. From the cut of a hoodie to the finishing of a seam, nothing is overlooked. Our supply chain is tight-knit and local, which means less crisscrossing the country and more care in every step. The result is durable clothing, t-shirts, hoodies, sweatpants, and denim that become part of your life season after season. This isn't fast fashion, it's clothing made with purpose by people who care as much about how it's made as how it fits. Get 20% off your first order with code STAPLE20 at American-Giant.com. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com with code STAPLE20.
Football on off the ball.
Oh, I think they have to. I mean, what's the alternative? That they say it's like, no, you have to play him. Well, Schloss's response to that would be, well, okay, if you're picking the team, in what sense am I actually the coach, you know?
Join in the obsession. Subscribe now at offtheball.com/join.
Right then, very happy to say that Kieran Murphy of the Second Captains podcast of the Irish Times, an author of two books and now officially a hurling man, has joined us in studio. Kieran, you're very welcome.
This is a controversial statement to start this off. I mean, I'm certainly not on the executive floor, but maybe I'm in the lobby of the hurling man complex. I'm not entirely sure, but thank you for that. Yeah.
Did you manage to find the office okay today? Do you need directions?
Well, I flirted with Google Maps, but actually, you know, your body falls into certain rhythms around this town, you know, so it was as if my feet just took me here.
Yeah.
So it's lovely to be back after 12 years.
Did you shed one solitary tear when you realised that PMAX has been changed to a different chain? Peters is still there, I guess.
Yeah, Peters is still there. It's great to see Michael McCarthy. I always think I wasted about 3 years of my life in Peters Pub with Michael McCarthy. So it's great to see old faces and new faces. You're literally here a decade and you're a new face in my book. So that's basically that's how long ago it is since I was on this show.
Yeah. To kind of give some credence to the Hurling Man tag, you were on Delo's hurling pod yesterday.
Yeah.
They literally do not have anything other than hurling men on that podcast. So surely that is a statement of your hurling madness.
Honestly, if you'd asked me 36 hours ago, I'd have just said no chance. But I feel like my hand has been stamped in some way. If there are 40 steps to go through to be a hurling man, I'm probably on stage like 14. And 13 of those are related to appearing on that podcast yesterday. So yes, another lifelong ambition fulfilled for me to be on that podcast. So it was actually great fun, genuinely great fun. As you can well imagine.
Yeah, for sure. The book is called Old Parish, Notes on Hurling. As I say, it's your second book. Old Parish equals Unshan Fubble, which is the name of the Waterford club, the dual Waterford club that you end up spending a summer with. Talk us through the background here and your connection with this club and your connection with Waterford.
Yeah, so my dad was born in Unshan Fubble in 1948 and he left in probably 67, I think, for Dublin, and went from Dublin. He met a Galway woman in Dublin and married my mother and moved to Galway in like the early 80s. So he actually hasn't lived back in Unshan Fubble since leaving it in 1967. But my uncles played for Unshan Fubble throughout the 60s and 70s. My uncle is still involved as kind of a club grandee down there. So I've always had a connection to West Waterford and to Unshan Fubble in particular. I have an aunt who lives in Orion as well. She was a banatee in the Gaeltacht down there, with the Gaeltacht College down there. So it's a part of the world that I've known for like my entire life, obviously. But I grew up where my mam's family, where my mam is from, you know. So I just know all my cousins on my mother's family really, really well. And I would not have had that kind of a relationship with my cousins in Waterford. So I've been heading down to Unshan Fubble for, as I say, my entire life. But this was kind of another level. I decided to move down nearly on a whim, on a publishing whim, and spent 6 months down there. And genuinely, kind of, it changed my life, to be honest. It's the most beautiful part of the country imaginable. The people are daft on GA, so warm, so welcoming to me on a personal level. And I know that it's kind of different. I did have that familial connection there, but genuinely, Yeah, it was just an incredible way to spend a year, you know. And my wife's a school teacher, so she was able to come down for like a large portion of the time that I was down there as well. So really, just a mad, beautiful experience, you know.
It sounded amazing. I think a lot of people are going to pick up this book and just be unbelievably jealous of the summer that you spent down there. And from what I understand, it's potentially not the only summer that you spent in Waterford playing hurling as well. Do you think you would have done this even if there wasn't a publishing opportunity?
Yeah, so that's a really interesting question. What I had to wrestle with from early on was the idea that it's a stunt for a book. You know, and you have to own it. You have to really say, like, that's what this is. I had an idea for a book. It necessitated moving down to Unchannable. It necessitated me joining the GA club and playing with them. But genuinely, within, I don't know, a couple of weeks of being down there, I realised that there was something else going on, kind of emotionally with myself, with sort of life decisions that you decide to make. And I knew that this was the right decision to make at a certain period in your life. Like, I've lived in Dublin. Like, I came up to DCU in 2003. I started here in 2004. So I've been in Dublin for 22 years, and I would never have thought, and I'm obviously a country lad, and I would have never really wrestled with the idea of living anywhere other than Dublin. And it's not that I'm planning on moving out of the city, but there was a realization, I think, that you do need to touch grass sometimes, you know. And yeah, so for that reason, of course, it was a stunt for a book. It was a quirky idea for a book. 41-year-old man decides to take up hurling and, you know, hilarity ensues. But you also have to take it as you find it as well. And, you know, that's what I found, was just this far deeper emotional connection, even than probably I was prepared for.
Like, I presume it had been something that you'd been asked quite a lot in the years you'd been living in Dublin. Will he ever move back? And maybe the idea of moving back to Galway was seen as some sort of life regression.
Yeah.
Whereas actually that's not the same as saying, oh, I wouldn't ever move to the countryside.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, yeah, exactly. Like, that question is framed in you know as well. Like, that question is often framed in a very specific kind of way, which is like, have you had enough of this noise?
The rat race.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Whereas, you know, like, people also work in the countryside, you know, they also need to earn a living. So, I always kind of rejected the framing of it as well as the idea of it. Whereas now I'm just way more open to the idea of, if not living down in the countryside, at least spending 2 or 3 months every year, you know. That's a very sort of privileged thing to be able to even contemplate. But yeah, like, you gotta sort of take the lessons when they keep knocking you over the head. The happiness that I felt down there is something you probably would be best not to ignore.
What was your hurling experience as a participant like before this book?
Okay, there's kind of three strands to this. The first one would be, like, I grew up with hurlies in the house, but they might have been the only hurlies in Milltown, I would say, in that my dad would have played a bit when he was a boy, obviously, in Waterford. So we would have knocked around in the backyard a bit, like, but a very, very small bit. It was a football only, a monotheistic culture that we're dealing with in Milltown in North Galway. And then I would have taken hurlies when I was moving kind of from house to house in the noughties. If friends of mine were going to the Phoenix Park for a kick around, sometimes we'd bring an American football, sometimes we'd bring a rugby ball and a kicking tee, and other times you would bring a hurley and a couple of scissors and we would be pucking around. I was obviously utterly useless and by a mile the best of my friends at this. You know, like, there was literally no one who was even like the first cousin of a hurler in sort of my friendship group. So that would have been, I would have been tipping along in that kind of respect. And then there's, like, I remember there was like a Media Gales team that I would have played on with Owen McDevitt and a number of other of the sort of GA journals. We used to play like Croke Park in, the games still happen from time to time, like Croke Park employees in Croke Park. Literally the only half of hurling, organised hurling, that I'd ever played prior to writing this book was literally in Croke Park against like the Croke Park staff. And that was like 20 minutes of a hurling game where I just ran around and tried not to suffer a grievous injury. And then sort of the third strand of that then is, over during COVID, you're obviously working from home, gotta walk the dog. There's a GA pitch right beside me in Kilmainham. Go up there with the dog Hurley, a couple of Slithers. It would take a lot of self-restraint for you to not sort of, you know, idly like be whacking balls over the bar, you know? And so that was happening for a couple of years. But that's literally the extent, other than watching the game, loving the game, reporting on the game, waxing lyrical about the game for 20 years, obviously. But that was literally the extent of the participation. And like the Phoenix Park puck arounds, it's kind of interesting because it's only in the course of writing the book that I realised this is literally how the GAA started. Mm. You know, Michael Cusack decided in January of 1884 to have a puck around with some friends because he enjoyed playing hurling and he didn't want to sort of let the whatever enjoyment he got out of it to just wither on the vine. And that's literally how the GAA started. So that was kind of a lovely, like, lovely sort of callback in my mind to, okay, this is actually how it all began. This is, it's actually natural for you to fall into hurling in this way. This is the way you should fall into hurling. But of course, it's not. For so many people, it's regimented, you know, the Gerlach Nan line that I quote, you know, if you haven't started by the age of seven, it's probably too late. What he means there is codified training, structured training sessions as a kid. And like, he's right to the extent that you need to start to at that stage to attain excellence, but I kind of see it in a different way. Is there a way that you can engage with the game that has nothing to do with the GAA, nothing to do with, you know, a pitch and a referee and umpires and linesmen? You know, is there a way that you can actually commune with the game, similar to, I don't know, a kid and his dad or mum in America throwing a baseball back and forth? This idea that it's just a ritual that you go through in your childhood and you can keep going with it, or you can just leave it with other childish things when you get to 18. That was the relationship that I had with hurling. And in ways, it's obviously very different now in that I've played organized, but that's also what I'm going to return to, and that's lovely as well. That will be my relationship with hurling for the rest of my life, hopefully, and I kind of want to keep that up as well.
Because it's very clear from the book that you were a really deep admirer of everything that hurling represents in the eyes of the great hurling men, the mystique of hurling, the history, as you've touched on there. That's not something that you've suddenly just become aware of as a result of writing this book. The sort of warrior-like imagery that we use around hurling was something that obviously you would have been deeply aware of and possibly used yourself. Did you feel that warrior-like mythology when you were playing the game as well?
Well, that's an interesting and possibly leading question. I think I fell some way short of warrior-like.
I don't know, it's maybe not becoming an actual Cú Chulainn out there Kelly, but is there even sort of a low-down version of that that you can feel just by pucking off the handball alley that you described in one of your summer homes that you rented out during the book? Do you feel it maybe when you're just training, even when you talk about walking your dog and, you know, pucking the ball over the bar and your dog's coming back? Are you feeling that sort of
Well, absolutely.
That nature?
I think what I really feel is an understanding of how difficult the sport was, which was kind of hammered home to me, obviously, time and time again. But also kind of an understanding of the minutiae of the sport in a really kind of lovely way. There's a moment kind of late on in one of the games. The season happened in a kind of a strange way. So I went down there kind of end of March, and then there was like a series of league games, and the league is just completely ignored and, you know, not made, not taken all that seriously at all in Waterford, which was brilliant. Obviously, I got way more game time than any reasonable expectation I could have had. But I got it all, it was all kind of front loaded. So I was like, I barely started training, and then all of a sudden I was into like game situations that I was not capable, not really fit for. And then I trained all summer, but the championship starts in August. So by the time I got to August, I was probably five times the hurler I was when I was getting all my game time, but I wasn't getting which is actually fine, because I was going down there to train and to learn how to play. The games genuinely were kind of bonuses. But there was at one stage a training session maybe in the August, kind of right in the middle of kind of a championship run that we were on, where There's a ball that comes to my... So I'm left-handed, so I'm so the ball is coming down the left-hand side. So basically what I need to do is swap the hurley from one hand to the other and catch the ball with the on the side that the ball is coming to. And then as I gather possession, change hands on the hurley and then be ready to go. And so I didn't do that. But afterwards I'm thinking, I have the thought, like I'm frustrated that I haven't done that. And then I was kind of thinking afterwards, that is, on the other hand, very much a hurling man thing to think, you know? So there were moments like that where it's nothing to hurling people because it's all instinctive. Whereas nothing that I was doing on the hurling field was instinctive. I literally had to think about everything that I had to do, and that obviously kills you, you know, it absolutely kills you. So there were these moments, you know, and there was a moment again in training where a ball hops once in front of me and I get the ball into my hand and the guy behind me is, he's gotten too close to me so I can kind of roll him. And then I tap the ball off my hurley, take my four steps, get to the 20 metre line and, you know, like whack it in underneath the, off the underside of the crossbar with that beautiful sound that a ball hitting the underside of the crossbar makes. And I immediately thought, this is it. I've cracked it. Like this, I feel just completely in charge of what I'm doing here. I know what I have to do. I know where to go. I know what to do. It's, you know, a light bulb moment. And literally the next four balls that come into me, I just drop for no reason. I just, the ball is in my hand and then all of a sudden it's not in my hand. And that's basically the whole season in a nutshell. You know, that there are these flashes of thinking you've met it or you've cracked it or whatever, and then the game just comes and kicks you up the arse again, you know, because that's just the way of the world. It's just, it's such a difficult sport, genuinely an incredibly difficult sport if you haven't started early, but it's kind of the fun of it, you know. That's why you do hard things. It's to figure out whether you can do them or not and derive true satisfaction from doing it right even once.
But that's not been your experience of Gaelic Games, of participating in Gaelic Games, because when it comes to football, fairly handy at football and you've never kind of felt the experience, for example, as you point out, of being the person who gets the look from the lad out the field. Oh, the only guy who's free is the number 14. I can't kick him the ball. So you've gone from the person who's giving that look to actually receiving
the look.
First of all, did you feel like, geez, the people who give that look, they're a bit of a dick to be given that look, you know? I mean, we should all be included here. Or are you very much thinking, no, he's absolutely dead right. I know exactly what it feels like.
Time. It's always vanishing. The commute, the errands, the work functions, the meetings, selling your car. Unless you sell your car with Carvana. Get a real offer in minutes. Get it picked up from your door. Get paid on the spot. So fast, you'll wonder what the catch is. There isn't one. We just respect you and your time. Oh, you're still here? Move along now. Enjoy your day. Sell your car today. Carvana. Pickup fees may apply.
With the state of today's economy, it is more important than ever to invest in products that last for years to come. As the seasons shift and get cooler, make sure your closet is stocked with durable layers that stand the test of time from American Giant. American Giant's clothes work harder and are wearable season after season. Their greatest hoodie ever made is made of the highest quality materials that are cut and sewn right here in the United States. So you're investing right back into your local community. Choosing American Giant means taking a stand for American manufacturing and hardworking Americans, something other mega corporations don't care about. From fleece to knit, all in a range of colors for versatile daily wear, American Giant delivers everyday pieces designed for everyday life. Feel the difference of quality made to last clothes from American Giant. Get 20% off your first order with code STAPLE20 at American-Giant.com. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com with code STAPLE20.
Yeah, I think, you know, my initial reaction was, you know, we're all out here trying our best. And then immediately within like half a second, that thought gets completely swallowed by, he's absolutely right, we've a game to win. So no, there was no period of self-reflection. There was no personal growth in that respect, I'm proud to say. But yeah, I mean, what's interesting about it, I suppose, is that it's not, I didn't take up cricket, you know. I didn't walk down the pavilion with the pads on. I didn't, you know, face spin bowling or something. I was literally in this place where I felt perfectly comfortable, and I wasn't much of a footballer, but I was perfectly comfortable on the football, Gaelic football field, for my entire life, since I was 7 or 8 years old. You know, the pitch is the same, the people on the sideline are the same, the colour of the jersey is the same, and yet this place where I've always felt completely comfortable is now terrifying to me, not from a like a physical danger standpoint, but just the possibility of ritual humiliation was, you know, constant. So that, like, that was kind of a bit of a head melter, to be honest, you know?
Yeah. Which is great content. But yeah, is there a real part of you that's thinking this is deeply frustrating?
Oh, of course. Yeah, absolutely. And I got so frustrated because I really did want, I did really want for it to work out, in a different way to how it did. I mean, I was going to say better. I mean, I wouldn't change a minute of it, to be honest. But, you know, I did hope that I was going to be better than I was. But on the other hand, you know, you're writing a book about a famously difficult sport. And if the upshot of the book was, actually, you know, not that difficult, then maybe, you know, what I lost in personal humiliation, I gained perhaps from a publishing point of view. So maybe that's for the best. But you know the point I'm making? Like, there's... After a couple of training sessions, actually, I didn't know what I didn't know. And I actually did think, you know, this actually is going to be, it's actually going to be not that bad.
Yeah.
And then, you know, you're thrown into your first game, or training moves up a notch, and you get a few lads back from college, and you realise, actually, you are so far off this, it's ridiculous. So maybe it's for the best I learned that particular lesson.
You detail the story of your relationship with... a couple of hurling Yodas, I want to call them, Jamie Wall and Sinead O'Carroll in particular, and Paul Rouse, name checked in the book, the people who kind of guide you through this journey. Yeah. Obviously, the best learning is through the practice in terms of training and in the matches. Any nugget that you got from that trio, from any of your Yodas that you pass on to any prospective hurling player and say, that is the one, that's the one thing you need to know?
Yeah, well, Jamie, I would have often left Jamie just these voice notes, kind of howls into the dark, which were very useful in the writing of the book, because you're like, God, I really was feeling it that day. But there was one game in particular down in beautiful Capoquin where I was just so terrible, so irredeemably awful in every possible aspect. And Jamie kind of listened to me, you know, just whining and whining and whining and whining. And Dink says, you know, hurling is just not a thinking man's game.
Which sounds like a very negative thing to say about hurling in general until you understand actually what he means.
Yeah, it's an instinctive game. If you're thinking, you're gone, you know? And then there was another moment, it was about maybe 3 days before my first game, I met Sinead up here for Puck Around. And I was like, I had to come back up for work, so I was missing training. So I was like, Sinead, I just want to feel like I've done something in the run up to this game, you know? And so she was literally on her way to Camogie training, and she stopped in and we pucked around for half an hour. She's like, okay, what do you want to do, you know? And I was like, well, Sinead, to be honest, I think if you go out kind of 70 yards out from goal and you just rain balls in on top of me, I'll catch them, turn around and stick them in the back of the net. And she was like, okay. And we did that for a few minutes. Then she kind of wandered in her front. She's like, what do you actually think you're going to be doing in this game, you know? And I was like, well, something along the lines of standing on the edge of the square, catching balls, turning around and putting them in the back of the net, no? And she was like, you'll be lucky if you touch the ball 5 times. What you're actually going to be doing is, the ball is going to be on the ground in front of you. You're going to be using your arse to get people out of the way, and you're just going to be mullocking, you may as well have a spade for all that you're going to be doing in this game. And I was quite offended by this, to be honest. But then cut to 3 days later, and I was like, Sinead is an unfailingly optimistic person, it turns out, because that's literally what I was doing, but just maybe not with the frequency with which she was predicting it. So yeah, I mean, Rice is a football man, no more than myself, but he was an incredible help to me on the sort of, the book has kind of a twin track in a lot of ways, in that there's this kind of personal story, and then there's also the broader questions of where hurling is played, where it isn't played, why that is, and actually the limitations around kind of our own thinking on that.
Yeah, which is really, really interesting. And I mean, I think one of the more fascinating aspects of the cultural history of hurling is the story of the Yank who comes into town, Roy the Rover style.
Yeah, yeah.
What's the name of the movie?
Jedinar is the book.
Oh, the book.
And it was written by a guy called Callan Sheehan in the kind of 1900s, 1910s maybe. And it's just a book lying around in my house in Galway. And my mam remembers reading it in primary school. And my uncle, who's Jim Carney, remembers reading it in... And when I first told him the idea, Jim was like, oh, you should read Glen and Eyre. It's great. And it's a completely insane book. It's a completely insane series of books about kind of like a priest in Donnerail in Cork who just goes around solving everyone's problems. So suffice to say, it's the only one of the Callan Sheehan canon that I've read, but nevertheless, maybe, you know, I'll get round to more. But Glen and Eyre, yeah. And like...
So you basically fulfilled the role of the Yank down in Shannon Fubble. You would arrive and you would...
That was the dream. I don't know that I did the business to the extent that the Yank did against whoever it was. It was like the Shandon Thrashers or whoever it was. But listen, go find it in your local library, kids. Glen and Eyre by Callan Sheehan, yeah.
The discovery of finding yourself as a hurling man, and it's kind of a two-worded phrase that properly does it justice, hurling man, because... Your manliness is something that I think you question quite a lot throughout this.
Constantly, Owen, throughout the writing of this book and before and indeed, I'm sure, after.
Basically, manliness in a hurling sense equals complete disregard for your own safety?
I would say so, yeah. Like, the worst injury I got was, like, some kind of repetitive strain injury in my hand just from catching the slither. So, I mean, I got a couple of whacks on the finger, all right. And again... Pedagogically speaking, no better way to learn to put your hurley up to protect yourself as you try and catch the ball than to just get whacked on the top of your nail time and time again. But yeah, I mean, there was funny, like I've been playing Gaelic football all my life, so the physicality element I wasn't that bothered by in a weird kind of way. It was more just like my own foolishness, you know, like my own, and it's not even disregard. Like disregard suggests that you understand the danger, but you nevertheless blunder in. Whereas I had a feeling that I wouldn't understand the danger and as a result would, through no bravery, you know, sustain some sort of devastating injury. Or indeed actually cause an injury. That was a big thing for me as well, to be honest, because you obviously have this, you know, 3-foot plank of wood that you don't know how to use. And you're kind of steaming into these situations and... Like, that was in ways, like, out of just, like, no one would expect me to be as bad as I could be, if you know what I mean. And so they might be presuming that I would be, like, my own mother said to me before my first game, is like, something along the lines of, do you not think you should tell the man you're on that you've never played hurling before and that you're a bit of a danger? And that's quite an offensive thing to say. I think anyone would agree that that is gravely offensive to one's masculinity. But there is a large dollop of truth to what she said, you know, that just by accident, just like swinging the hurley on a plane that an actual hurler would never do might cause someone devastating injury. Luckily, we all escaped relatively unscathed.
Yeah,
I speak for all of the hurlers, Junior B hurlers of West Waterford when I say that.
And any little mark that you did leave on an opponent was quickly reciprocated to you as well, and all is fair. There is obviously the thing that you would have considered time and again, which is, you know, trying to get your hands on a couple of new hurls.
Yeah.
And like the cleanliness of them, the wearing of the glove.
Yeah.
I mean, the rawness, you were trying to kind of capture your own sense of rawness in all of this, and wearing something like a glove or brandishing a fresh hurl probably wouldn't have gone down too well.
Like, completely. And you kind of... you wrestle with the last thing you want to do is stand out for anything other than just being terrible as well. Do you know what I mean? So the glove is fine if you're TJ Reid or Richie Hogan or, you know, who, or anyone good. But then if you're wearing a glove and you're also terrible, there are certain connotations. And I had to work through those to the point where, okay, my hand is literally gone, like it's a gamut from purple to sort of a jaundiced yellow, from like the middle of my palm stretching up to like top knuckle on 3 of my fingers. Some remedial action should be taken here. So it's hilarious the amount of conversations I've had about the glove. So many people want to talk to me about the glove, and most of them to say, I don't even know what protection you're getting. Like, you get a protection from a whack on the back of the hand as you're catching the ball, for sure. But you don't really get much protection from the pat, but you do get a little bit of protection. And that's what I was looking for. Like, even just like a fig leaf of protection there did actually do the trick. But yeah, I mean, it is, as you say, like the warrior sport. You know, we kind of we buy into that and we kind of lean into that. And it was really eye-opening for all my friends that I was telling. Listen, I'm moving to Waterford, I'm going to play hurling. You know, and a lot of my friends have no interest in the GAA, certainly no interest in hurling. But their immediate reaction was, oh my God, you'll get killed. You know, so I think maybe it is a hangover from the days of no helmets and, you know, Tommy Walsh getting his head split open and, you know, tis but a scratch kind of vibes that hurlers would have given out. Like, it's obviously still a ridiculously, I was going to say dangerous. It's not, it requires an incredible amount of bravery to play it at the highest level. But I didn't, that was not a thing that I was worried about, funnily enough. It was more just the skills part of it that was scary to me.
Time. It's always vanishing. The commute, the errands, the work functions, the meetings, selling your car. Unless you sell your car with Carvana. Get a real offer in minutes. Get it picked up from your door. Get paid on the spot. So fast, you'll wonder what the catch is. There isn't one. We just respect you and your time. Oh, you're still here? Move along now. Enjoy your day. Sell your car today.
Carvana.
Pickup fees may apply.
With the state of today's economy, it is more important than ever to invest in products that last for years to come. As the seasons shift and get cooler, make sure your closet is stocked with durable layers that stand the test of time from American Giant. American Giant's clothes work harder and are wearable season after season. Their greatest hoodie ever made is made of the highest quality materials that are cut and sewn right here in the United States. So you're investing right back into your local community. Choosing American Giant means taking a stand for American manufacturing and hardworking Americans, something other mega corporations don't care about. From fleece to knit, all in a range of colors for versatile daily wear, American Giant delivers everyday pieces designed for everyday life. Feel the difference of quality made to last clothes from American Giant. Get 20% off your first order with code STAPLE20 at American-Giant.com. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com with code STAPLE20.
Yeah, like falling in love with hurling is one part of this. There's also kind of falling in love with the place. And you talk about your uncle at the top and how he's a real sort of grandee of the area and how he's a real character, I think it's fair to say.
Yeah.
Like, you speak a little bit about how you almost got involved in
the Ashtory and Shannon football. Yeah. Like, they're like ridiculously vibrant local drama scene down there. But, you know, what really, I could speak for hours, honestly, about it, but living in a Gaeltacht area, you realise that there are challenges to living in a Gaeltacht area. Like, and obviously, I was down there trying to speak a bit of Irish, and my hurling is bad, my Irish is worse. And when you're terrible at something, it's just so tiring. And then you're trying to speak Irish as well. So, like, all of that is tough, but I loved it. You know, my dad is a Gaelgore. Like, my brother edited on Colleen Kuhn. He's edited like 4 feature films in Irish. He's brilliant Irish. I'm jealous of that, genuinely really jealous of that. So you want to try and do that as well. But yeah, like, you get a real understanding that these people want to live where they're born. And, you know, they want to have the right to housing protected in these areas. They're doing incredible work preserving our culture, preserving our language. We all know that that needs to be respected. We know it in our bones. But to live it, to go down there and understand the challenges that they have, you know, like, they don't want people like me buying holiday homes down there or whatever. And you have to just, like, sit with that as well. And you just have to realise that's not... You know, like, they want housing down there. They want housing for people to raise families down there. And, that was really important to me as well, that I got some sort of sense of, you know, the community that's down there. And I knew that I would a little, but I didn't expect, I don't know, the degree of friendships that I have down there, the connection that I have to people down there. For all that I knew I'd have a good time down there, I was completely taken aback by just how intimate it felt. You know, I was like, I lived in kind of a cottage down a little laneway, and there was kind of gates across the front yard or whatever, but everyone would just, you know, you'd be out there in the summertime and everyone would just stop the car and just roll the window down and just say hello to you, you know. And a guy came up to me at one stage and he said, listen, you don't know me now, but I know who you are, and I was friends with your granddad. And my granddad died in 1975, I think. And so I never knew him. I'd never met the man. But this guy comes up and he says, listen, I knew him for years through farming and through the GA and that. And I've forgotten what he looks like. So you wouldn't have a photograph of your granddad that you could show me. And I didn't have one on me and I had to apologise. And then the more I thought about it, I was thinking to myself, I actually don't have a picture of him in my head. And this is my grandfather. And I knew my three other grandparents, and they were huge parts of my life growing up. And so as the summer went on, I forgot about this. I was really emotional when he asked me, and then I just kind of put it to the back of my mind and forgot about it. And then as I was kind of packing up for the year, it's like, geez, I never got a photograph for that man. And I found this photograph. And my Uncle John, who lives down in Uncharnofobel, doesn't look anything like me. And in a way, my granddad and his dad doesn't look anything like him or me. But you put the three of us together and you're like, that's three generations of the same family. You right. know? And it really packed this huge, like, emotional punch to me that, like, even at that most basic level, of course you look like your granddad. You know, that shouldn't be a surprise to you at all. But it was a connection that I just kind of not let go of, but I'd never tended it in my life, you know? And then to live down there for 6 months and to continue the relationship that I have done since long after the kind of the action of the book is over, you know, that's a gift in my life that I could never repay the people of Uncharnofobel for that. And so that's, you know, that's kind of something you just have to try and sit with as a man in his mid-40s. You know, you actually just have to try and figure out why that means as much as it does, that you look at a picture of your granddad and say, that massive nose he has, that's my nose. You know, you just have to, like, just roll with it, you know?
But it's also something that you have to sit with in a practical sense as well. Like, you are somebody who lives in Dublin. You are somebody who I presume would consider himself from Galway. Mm. And I'm sure after this, increasingly from Waterford. Part of you is from Waterford. Like, how do you sit with the fact that you've got all these different places pulling at you? And knowing that summer's kind of done and the possibility to go back down there again is also there.
Yeah. I think it's a thing we have to wrestle with as country people who live in Dublin. What is it to say that you're from a place? You know, is it actually just the memory of growing up there? Is it the people that you return to now? Is it kind of a feeling, an absence in your life of, as you know, a centre? I wrote in my first book, I lifted from a brilliant book called Minor Monuments by Ian Mullany. I've gotten the name of that book wrong. Ian Mullany is a beautiful writer, but what he writes about the loss that you feel when you grow up in the country and move to the city. What it basically amounts to is that you lose the ease with which you answer the question, where are you from? You know, that the center of your universe is a very easy thing to put your finger on when you are born, live your life and die in the same place. And that's a loss, obviously. But in another way, you know, what is life? Only an accumulation of experiences. So, you know, I was born in Milltown. I will always be a Milltown person. That's the answer to the question, where I'm from is Milltown in County Galway. But I think what you have to realise is that Dublin has been amazing to me for, you know, 22 years, and that I didn't discover anything last year. I suppose it was just opened up to me, this half of my family that's also from Waterford, and that so much of that was poured into me without my knowledge. You know, that, my father's love of Irish, my father's dedication to the idea of volunteerism in the GAA, but also kind of more in a broader community sense. All that stuff is stuff that he learned from Unchanna Fubble. So I'm not discovering that for the first time. Maybe I'm just picking up that thread that was left, you know?
That image of the lad stopping his car, though, and asking for a photo of your grandfather is a really powerful thing, because the Milltown connection is very easy to explain. You've lived 20-something years of your life there. The Dublin thing is very easy to explain. There have been a collection of brilliant anecdotes told throughout this book, but you would almost categorise that as the third most important of the three.
Yeah.
But that anecdote of being asked for a photograph of your grandfather almost elevates that to a whole new level. Like, that's not an experience of you and your grandfather, but it almost brings him back to some sort of current day memory.
It absolutely does. And the book is dedicated to Mahinshire. I went looking for... Basically, I was... So obviously, I played football down there as well. And the Comórtas Pealna Gaeltachta launch was being held in Croke Park. And my manager had heard, like, my pigeon Irish in the... on the trading field. He was like, oh, sure, you could do that. You know, you can do the Comórtas launch, you know? You can arrange your work. And I was like, obviously, if I wasn't writing a book, I would tell this guy to, like, please, not in a million years. But when you're writing a book, sometimes you just have to say, you got to lean into these uncomfortable situations. So I had, like, this hilarious day, like, trying to speak Irish to all of these... to the assembled media and to my fellow players. Like, it was a nightmare, because you're just face to face with your limitations in a really, like, awkward scenario. But I did try and prepare, like, a stump speech effectively to try and get me out of as many awkward situations as possible. And I went looking for the Irish word for it's where my people are from. It's, you know, it's not, I didn't want to just say it's where my dad's from. It's like where all of my people are from on that side of my family. And the translation is Mahinshire. And Shinshire is senior. And the only time I've ever heard that word is in a GAA context, you know. So it's the, you know, the Fern senior in a club or whatever is the club senior team. And I just kind of felt like that closed the circle in a really nice way as well. Like, the idea of family, Gaelin, and the GAA, it's kind of all summed up in that word, you know, because it's like, I found a team down there and all of my teammates are, you know, they're my team. But then you also find this kind of, this collection of people long dead and older generations and younger generations of my, like, I was playing with my cousins, and that was a thrill as well. You know, you kind of feel a part of something there, like it's not just a guy from Dublin moving down for a summer. It's like, it's a part of my life, and I'm a part of Old Parish, and my brothers are parts of Old Parish because half of them that's where they're from.
Yeah.
And so I just felt that was, the whole, in ways, the book was summed up in that word.
Yeah, it's not just parachute journalism. Maybe you parachuted in and left with something really, really meaningful as well.
Yeah, exactly.
And knew the coordinates before you flew in. There are two final things I just want to ask you about. First of all, doing things that you're terrible at in your 40s is a theme. And you say that people essentially don't live outside their comfort zone, don't try new things, don't try things that they know they're going to be bad at the start after their 20s. Have you rediscovered, as a result of doing this, a newfound appetite for things you're difficult at?
Absolutely not.
Or you're terrible at it?
Never again. No, I enjoyed it. And it's, the Irish is a big thing, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, using the cúpla focal is a big thing for, like, your generation. You're younger than me. You know, there are cultural touchstones that you had that I didn't have. And I'm talking about TG Carr being set up in whatever it was, 96, 95. And I was 13. And I kind of feel like if I'd been born 10 years later, my dad would have just been a lot more comfortable speaking more Irish in the house and just having that as part. You know, Gaelscoileanna were just not a thing when I was in primary school or in secondary school. Whereas now my mum and dad sit down, they watch the games on TG Carr, and they speak Irish to each other during the game. So as they're, like, making observations about the game, it's in Irish. Because, like, mum was taught entirely Trí Gaeilge in secondary school, and dad obviously is a Gaelgor. So they would just, if they're hearing Irish and watching a game through Irish, they're talking to each other as Gaeilge. And I would love to have that, even just that conversational level of Irish. And it's something I'm working on. So yeah, I mean, that, like, I don't know about anything else. I'm not going to decide to, you know, I was going to say take up cricket. I don't know why I'm talking about cricket. I have the Ashes in my brain here. But yeah, I don't know that I'm going to be volunteering for a whole lot of other things I'm terrible at, to be honest. Like, two things is probably enough: hurling and Graelin.
And then finally, your appreciation for just the great hurlers of the modern era. You talk about going to watch the All-Ireland final last year, the Tony Kelly goal, one of the greatest goals we've ever seen in an All-Ireland final. I appreciate how great that is as a non-hurling man.
Yeah.
Do you have a greater appreciation of how great it is as a fully-fledged hurling man now?
Yeah, that's the question. Like, I think, I don't want to overstate it, you know, like, you've been watching hurling your entire life. I've been watching hurling. Like, you don't need a roadmap for that, you know. It's like reading Ulysses as just a regular punter and then doing it in college, you know. So, like, you know, you read Ulysses, you might love it, you know. It actually helps your understanding of the game if there's a college lecturer telling you what most of it's about, but it doesn't mean that you're necessarily enjoying it a whole lot more. You're just enjoying it on a slightly different plane. So I do remember, you know, the 2 weeks after that Ireland final last year, I'd be like boring people to tears about the one touch of the four touches off his hurley that Tony Kelly takes that for me really elevates it. And after a while it's like, I'm just being a bore.
The top four touches of Tony Kelly is all hurling.
Yeah, like, you're just being a bore. So is that what being a hurling man is all about, Owen? I don't know, but you absolutely have a deeper understanding of it. I don't think you have a deeper appreciation of it. We all appreciate how good the best of them are, but I think maybe you have. Maybe there is. I'd like to think that after it all, I understand it a bit more, I appreciate it a bit more, and my respect for the best hurlers was already intergalactic, but it's beyond that now, I think.
You get to be a little bit of a hurling snob if you so choose.
Yeah, exactly. The payoff. That club is in the bag, you know?
It's called Old Parish Notes on Hurling. It's an absolutely phenomenal read. Ciarán Murphy, congrats on this, and thanks many for popping in.
Thanks very much, Owen, and it was a genuine pleasure to be back here. This was, whatever it was, 9 years of my life, so it's a real pleasure to be back talking to Off the Ball, so thanks very much for the opportunity. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Ciarán.
With the state of today's economy, it is more important than ever to invest in products that last for years to come. As the seasons shift and get cooler, make sure your closet is stocked with durable layers that stand the test of time from American Giant. American Giant's clothes work harder and are wearable season after season. Their greatest hoodie ever made is made of the highest quality materials that are cut and sewn right here in the United States. So you're investing right back into your local community. Choosing American Giant means taking a stand for American manufacturing and hardworking Americans, something other mega corporations don't care about. From fleece to knit, all in a range of colors for versatile daily wear, American Giant delivers everyday pieces designed for everyday life. Feel the difference of quality made-to-last clothes from American Giant. Get 20% off your first order with code STAPLE20 at American-Giant.com. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com with code STAPLE20.